The National Toy Hall of Fame recently inducted three new toys this year, and all three have roots here in Cincinnati. The Magic 8-Ball, the card game Uno, and pinball machines. The Magic 8-Ball was created in 1946, and Abe Bookman had a significant impact on its final design. Nearly 50 years ago, Merle Robbins and his wife Marie from Reading came up with the Uno card game, now owned by Mattel. In 1871, Montag Redgrave applied for a patent for the improved game of Bagatelle, which introduced the spring-loaded plunger to shoot the ball and bell domes to create a ringing sound. Redgrave built these games here in Cincinnati and sold them to various businesses. With me in the studio tonight to talk about these toys are Brian Powers, local history librarian with the Public Library of Cincinnati and Hamilton County, who curated the library's Kenner Toy exhibit at the main branch downtown in December 2015, and Don Bookman, whose father invented the Magic 8-Ball. Brian and Don, welcome to Around Cincinnati.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lee.
Let's start with the Magic 8-Ball. Don, tell us about your father, Abe Bookman, who was born in 1898, and how he ended up in Cincinnati.
Well, he was born in Blanchester, Ohio, and his father had a foundry there. They lived there until his young teenage years and then moved first to Kings Mills and then to Avondale.
So tell us about who was working on this spirit writing device, which kind of prompted the transition into the Magic 8-Ball.
Albert Carter was the son of a woman who lived in Price Hill, who was very well known as a spiritualist, and she had as her prime way of speaking to the spirits a spirit tablet. She would have a tablet behind a curtain and apparently chalk or something, and it would miraculously be moved by the spirits to write answers onto the slate. Albert Carter developed a toy from that and marketed that or took it around town to see if he'd get someone interested in it.
And Laura Pruden, that was the psychic medium?
Yes.
She was internationally known, with even Sir Arthur Conan Doyle believing in her abilities.
Yes, and Houdini did not believe in her abilities, and I think at one time tried to debunk her, as he did many spiritualists.
So Albert Carter and your father, how did they team up together?
Albert Carter went into my uncle's furniture store on Central Avenue trying to come up with someone who would be interested in investing in his device that was called a psychoseer, and it was a fluid-filled tube with glass ends on it and a six-sided cube of wood that floated inside with answers, with words like yes, no, perhaps, written on the six different sides. And it was suspended in molasses, and as you turned this over, asked it a question, turn it back over again, and after some bubbling of the molasses, the cube would come to the surface, and you could read the words of the answer or non-answer in the glass.
And you brought with you one of these, which I'm sure is very rare.
Yeah, I don't think there's very many of them. I think it was either one of the very early ones that he developed himself, or, well, actually, it has the name of the company, Alibi Crafts, which was formed from Albert and Abe. My father was Abe Bookman, and he was Albert Carter. And they put Alibi, put those two first names together to be Alibi. But it was before it was ever patented. It was a pre-production model.
And a patent was applied for and put in your father's name in 1944. What happened after that?
Albert was a bit of a ne'er-do-well and an alcoholic, and he died shortly after that. Before he had died, actually, my father purchased the remaining part of the patent because they shared the patent for $350, but Albert told him not to give him the money all at once because he would only drink it up. So he gave him $50 a week over a period of time until it was all paid out. And then Albert did die not too long after that.
And then your father started tinkering with it?
Yes, he was a tinkerer and a problem solver, and he worked out a lot of the problems. Actually, the biggest problem with it was that you couldn't ship the thing anywhere because it was filled with fluid, and if you put it on a dock, it would either overheat in the summer or freeze in the winter and crack the glass, and then it was no good. So he came up with a diaphragm that allowed the tube of glass to be completely filled up to the top so that there was no air bubble in there, and the diaphragm would either go up or down depending on expansion or contraction of the fluid inside, and so you didn't have a bubble in it, and it can be shipped all around the world.
And how did it go from being a cylinder to a round?
Well, my father didn't see much marketing of the cylinder, so he started just trying other things and originally came up with a kind of iridescent ball to go around it like a fortune-telling ball. And then Brunswick saw that and said we could promote billiard games, pool games with the eight on it. So they made a black ball and they made a limited run with the eight on it. And then after that, the company progressed.
And where was the manufacturing plant?
Well, it started off just in a corner of the building down at 5th and Central that my uncle owned. And then as it expanded, they took over more and more of the building until they had pretty much the whole building. It was a 5-story building down there.
And how many pieces were they producing?
I don't know the exact numbers, but it was millions. All I can tell you is that when I worked down there as a teenager and through my years at UC, around August, September, when the big time of production was getting ready for the Christmas rush, you would look at the tables that were probably 20 by 20 feet filled in a huge pyramid with eight balls. You wonder, where are all these going to go? But they all got shipped out of there. So there were quite a few. There were millions of them.
Was it a production line where each person had a different part of the line?
Yeah, that was one of my father's geniuses, was for figuring out how to break things down into individual operations. He just invented all the machinery that went into the place, and none of it was commercially made. And they probably had a core of 20 or 25 employees. As they got bigger, it probably doubled or even tripled from that.
Didn't something happen to it around the 1970s?
In the 70s, the place had always been non-union, and the pay scale was more than what the toy industry normally paid. As they expanded and activism became more prevalent in the 70s, and they had a lot of new employees, they wanted to unionize, and they couldn't be unionized by the toy union because the pay scale was too high. So they were organized by the Meat Packers and Butchers Union. And the pay scale was just too high for the margins available so that they eventually sold the company to Ideal Toy Company. And then all the jobs were lost and the company was moved up to New York.
And then what did your dad do afterwards?
Well, he was older. He was probably late 70s by that time, and his partner Sid Corey, who I should have mentioned way before this, who was the sales manager and actually president of the company, he was in his mid-60s, and I think they both decided it was time to retire.
Did you attend the induction at the National Toy Hall of Fame?
No, I didn't. We were actually out of the country at the time, but it probably would have been interesting. We will have to make a pilgrimage there someday.
And Brian, let's go to Uno, the card game. Tell us about the history of that.
Sure. Well, Uno was invented by a father and son, and really the whole family up in Reading, a gentleman named Merle Robbins, who was a barber. He used to play a lot of games with his wife and family. His son was an adult, and they all came over and play all sorts of card games. And one of them was Crazy Eights they used to play a lot. And then they started playing like a form of Crazy Eights with two different decks of cards. And they started making up their own rules. And they would have debates about what the rules were. They would forget. And then what they did is they would write down the rules. So they started writing down the rules. And it sort of got finalized between Merle and his son, Ray. Then they got to be where they keep track of the cards. They were writing on the cards, you know, just regular playing cards. And then he decided that he'd get blank cards, and then he would draw on those so they would know what cards it was. And then it developed into the idea of, why don't we make real cards? So they went to U.S. Playing Cards and had real cards made. And they decided to start selling them. So each family member put in like $1,000 each. It was like $10,000. And they, I think the first one was about 5,000 decks that they had made. And he was selling them out of his barbershop. And then him and his wife believed it in so much that they decided to sell their house in Reading and went on the road. They got like a trailer and they went down in Texas and Florida, and they would stay at camping sites and things, and they would introduce it to people. And they were just selling it, and just really caught on. It really spread. Eventually, a guy in Chicago who had a funeral home loved it and wanted to take over it. And so I think they started playing those games in Reading around 69. Then they developed it, and they went on the road about 71. And then it wasn't very long after that that they sold out all the ones that they had, and they had to get print some more. But eventually, this guy from Chicago came in, and he took it over.
Did U.S. Playing Card print them?
The original ones, the original, maybe the first
5,000?
Probably 10,000. I think they sold out of the 5,000, and then they went back and had more. But yes, playing cards, it was a custom job. Like, they were making them. They didn't own it. It was Mr. Robbins who.
And then it went to Chicago?
Right. He was a funeral director. He created a company called International Games, and then he developed it. And then eventually another company took it over, and then Mattel has it now. They've had it, since, I think, since 92.
And Merle Robbins' son is still alive?
No, he passed away. He has one son, John, who's still around, who lives out in Milford. And when I did the, you know, a couple years ago at the library, I did the Kenner toys. And that's when I discovered that the Magic 8-Ball, I never knew. I mean, I grew up in Virginia. Of course, I had a Magic 8-Ball growing up, and I played Uno.
Who didn't? But,
and I lived here for 20 years, and I had no idea that until I did this Kenner thing that I found out these other toys had come out of Cincinnati. So then I was able to track down Don, who was able to let me borrow some photos and things like that for the exhibit. And then I tracked down John out in Milford, who had, you know, like when his dad went out on the road, he had a sign made that said, Uno, try it. It's fun. And he would have that on the side of the truck. And he still has that. So he let me borrow that for the exhibit at the library.
Now, Don, do you have any memorabilia from that time?
Oh, yes.
Besides what you brought in?
Yes, yes. We have a whole basement full of boxes of things that were left over, and I think we have one of just about every product that they made, and we still even now have a table behind our couch that displays all the new items that have come along since now Mattel owns it, and we just have a display of 8-Ball memorabilia.
Do you have any prototypes?
Yes, prototypes of pretty much everything we have. Everything that they made, and a lot of the things that they made that were based on the Magic 8-Ball were short runs for either specialty items for companies or attempts to expand the market, like a baseball that was white with red lacing on it, and anything that was round, pretty much they thought they could possibly market. Some things did better than others.
Do you have any plans for this memorabilia? Are you going to keep it in a family or donate it to a museum?
I don't know what will happen to it. A lot of the things we have now are from Sid Corey's families. When they broke up their household, we ended up with a lot of their stuff. And I guess my son or daughter will take it. Maybe some of the Corey kids will take it. The Coreys are also my cousins. So we'll
so
keep
it's all
it in
family.
The family. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Well, I've been in conversation with Brian Powers from the Public Library's main branch downtown and Don Bookman, son of the inventor of the Magic 8-Ball. Thanks for coming in tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Lee, for having us.
The National Toy Hall of Fame is located inside the Strong Museum in Rochester, New York, where these toys will be on permanent display. You'll find a link to the National Toy Hall of Fame at WVXU.org. For Around Cincinnati, I'm Lee Hay.
Timmy builds a little toy town, up so high, up so high, up so high to tumble down. Tumble to the floor and then, up so high, up so high, Timmy builds it up again. Well, isn't this a pretty town? How crowded the streets are.
Listen to all the trucks and cars. And here's a street full of all kinds of stores with wonderful things to buy. Come, let's go shopping. Open the door, shut the door. What shall we buy at the little toy store? Balloons and whirly twirlies for little boys and girlies. Open the door, shut the door. Now we've shopped at the little toy store. Oh, listen to that policeman's whistle. And look, down the main street of Timmy's Toy Town, here comes a parade. Timmy has a little drum, 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 drum. Now through the toy town, here they come. Here they come, drum, drum, drum. Down the street and over the hill, you can hear them marching still. Drum, 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 tweet, 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 ding, ding, ding. Over the hill, then all is still. Drum, tweet, ding, ding.